Coming up on the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast.
You can have mystical experience with just music by itself. The Sufis have done this for centuries. Mantra systems, sutra systems are words and sentences being repeated, and they take you to different altered states of consciousness. So it's very important to look into how acoustics, the physics of sound, are impacting the brain, the heart, every aspect in the human body, and the energetic aspect of the self, and creating different connections in training the entire body with different music. So it's important to select something more suitable in the psychedelic experience than Beatles. I love the Beatles, but they're not the most suitable thing, I'm afraid, in the psychedelic experience. What can one choose? Well, first of all, let's look outside of equal temperament, because this harmonic series is encoded within us.
Welcome to the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast, a conversation series with leaders in the psychedelic community, specifically for therapists, healers, retreat leaders, and passionate enthusiasts. Presented by Maya and hosted by me, Eamon Armstrong. Welcome back to the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast. I'm your host, Eamon Armstrong. Can sound help us disconnect from unhealthy habitual patterns? Today's guest, Alexandre Tenous, creator of the Sound Meditation Protocol, shows us how we can use harmonic frequencies to release trauma, enhance self-awareness, and live happier, healthier lives. Our conversation begins with Alexandre's explanation of harmonic frequencies and the problem with the quantization of the 12-tone scale. We discuss the value of sound in the context of psychedelic experiences, as well as sound meditation protocols, i.e. set and setting. We conclude with issues that need to be addressed when working with these powerful tools. Alexandre Tenous is an ethnomusicologist, sound therapist, and sound researcher. He is also the principal founder of Resonant Mind Collective. For the past 22 years, he has been researching the therapeutic and esoteric properties of sound from three different perspectives: Western scientific, Eastern philosophical, and shamanic societal beliefs, to gain a deeper understanding of how sound has been used to affect human consciousness. This search has led him to where art, science, philosophy, and spirituality intersect. He continues to do research on sound, teaches the method he has created, and lectures about sound throughout the world. And now, here's Alexandre Tenous. Do you have any rituals? Do you curate the set and setting in your life according to a lot of the research that you've done and the way in which your environment entrains your consciousness? Do you feel like that permeates your entire life at this point?
Yes, absolutely. It has been for a while, and I think it's very healthy to do that. I don't think reality is something to go through, but rather to navigate through. And we navigate through reality by learning to pay attention, to be present, attentive, to become aware of the mindset. And mindset is not just intentions. It's intentions, attention, will, awareness, presence of the mind, intuition, imagination, inspiration, logic, discernment, reasoning, 15 different things. So these are the filters, the lenses through which we experience reality, phenomenology, basically, in philosophy, the mechanics of the experience. Who's having the experience? Who am I? How am I observing? So yes, it's something that I try to become more and more aware of to create more presence, to understand the nature of reality.
And you've been doing field work for over 22 years. Do you remember the time at which you first became aware of the way that your consciousness is modulated by your environment in your studies or in your own personal experience? Do you recall a kind of light bulb moment where you began to look at the world that way?
Well, that started at an early age because I started practicing meditation at age 14, which is unusual.
I started with
transcendental meditation. Correct. And as we all know, meditation is involve in paying attention to how our thoughts create reality. And the ultimate point of meditation is not to stop the thought processes, but to relinquish getting engaged in thinking and overthinking and ruminating and taking things apart and developing these micro thoughts, feelings, and emotions. So that started at an early age. And then as I became more and more interested in Eastern philosophies and spirituality and many other things later on, that I became interested in Gnosticism, Hermeticism, Neoplatonism, mystery school teaching. Of course, I'd been studying music all along. And music as an art, as a practice, is all about the inner perceptions, how you are being moved by what you're playing. So consciousness is dramatically impacted by acoustics, the physics of sound. And that's what makes us include music everywhere and all the time. There must be a very important reason to make music such an indispensable art. It's not just an art. It's an art that goes beyond what people think of art. It's impacting so many levels of being, the mental, emotional, physical, energetic, and spiritual levels. Entrainment, basically, is what's going on. It's very complex processes. And so that's at the end what drives reality, no? Language is just that. Prayers, intentions, music, the mantra system, the sutra system, and meditation, incantations, all sorts of chants. So we have become entrapped in a world that is made of language that creates reality. And we become impacted by this inner dialogue that is within ourselves. Chat, the inner chat, the judgment, the labeling, which creates reality, naming things. And we create reality out of going along with this inner dialogue, resisting it, defying it, complaining about it, running scenarios, agreeing and disagreeing with it, resisting it, and the inner drama. That's basically where reality is. This is why people become depressed and full of anxiety, because they take the inner voice seriously. And even when they know that it's just a voice, they cannot snap out of it. So meditation is a system to stabilize this and tone it down and bring inner awareness and equanimity, which is an important word here, preserving state of psychological stability without being affected by inner or outer stimuli. So that's the word we create. And meditation, spirituality, psychedelics are all about demystifying that reality, demystifying the nature of being. Psychedelics in ancient Greek means revealing the mind, manifesting the mind, or revealing the soul. Unfortunately, that's not how it's understood these days. It's all projected outside and externalized, exteriorized, which is very problematic. But at the end, it's about understanding how the self creates that reality. We started dreaming and got lost in a dream. And spirituality is about waking the self up in a dream. And I believe psychedelics are about the very same thing, except because we take them out of context. And we don't question the context. Whatever indigenous people are telling us, we think whatever they're saying is what's going on. It's a lot more complex than that. What they tell us is the best way for them to understand that nature, and based on their cosmological model, based on how they explain what reality is. So I think we have the responsibility to take it further and explore it more and understand how does the shamanic model fit in spirituality and quantum physics and Gnosticism and so many other things that are about reality and nature of the self, nature of the mind.
Well, you've laid such a beautiful foundation for our conversation this afternoon. So with that, I just want to welcome you to the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast. I really appreciate you being here, and I know that you're very busy and taking your time to share your wisdom with us. And I've heard you say that there's no shamanic experience without sound. And I've thought a lot about the experience of sound in the context of any kind of altered state, but sound is extraordinarily impactful. And from what I understand of your work, your comprehension of sound and its ability to help us break out of these unhealthy patterns, these unhealthy ways that we speak to ourselves, is very sophisticated and might be kind of surprising for some of our listeners, many of whom are the ones who are trying to facilitate healing in others, who maybe want to put on a Beatles song or want to have like an emotive experience with a certain song that they want to play while they're supporting someone in an altered state. But you've spent your entire career going deep into many different musical traditions and come up with some really remarkable findings, which I'm very excited for us to share with our listeners today. So thank you so much for being on the show. And I'd love to talk about sound. And one thing that I'm really interested in is you said the 12-tone scale is like GMO to the octave, that we have taken harmonics and overtones and we've kind of crunched them into this kind of regimented scale. And then actually other musical traditions and other harmonics actually may be more powerful for liberating the mind.
Well, first of all, thank you for inviting me, Eamon. It's a great pleasure to be here with you and with whoever is listening to it. Yes, to be more exact, it's not the 12 half steps in the octave, it's the quantization of these 12 half steps. Quantizations mean we made them snap into grid. We made them equidistant. And for those who are listening who have not studied music, the half step is the smallest division in sound in the Western octave. And that's the distance between C and C sharp, C and D, C sharp and D. So the white and the adjacent black key on the piano, or one fret up or one fret down on the guitar, that's the half step. So the Western octave is equal to 12 half steps, C, C sharp, D, D sharp, E, F, all the way up to C, higher an octave, the doubling of the frequency. Not all octaves in the world, different musical traditions, are equal to 12. Some are 22, 24, 53, 72. Byzantine chants is 72. 53 is the Turkish octave, and so on and so forth. What quantized the Western octave and castrated its power is the equal temperament, a system that we created which gave us great advantages. Some of the advantages are basically to be able to tune piano to one tuning and be able to transpose a piece of music from one key to any other key. In a system that's not equal tempered, and there are different systems, the harmonic tuning, the just intonation, and so on and so forth, you can't go to a distant key when transposing. If you do that, the piece of music will start to sound out of tune. Transposition is moving the tonal center to a different key, for those listening who are not familiar with the term, and basically gave us advantages, but these advantages came at a cost. The cost is no longer following the blueprint of sound as nature gave it to us, as it's exemplified in the harmonic series notes, the tuning of the harmonic series frequencies, which is something that can be carefully studied in acoustics and mathematics as well. And musicians study the harmonic series as well. So you have three different people who are engaged in trying to understand this most complex thing we can probably study, the harmonic series. That quantization made us be less impacted by the harmony that we created. In a way, we have created a new harmony. And this new harmony is out of tune. And we start to perceive the real harmony, which humans resort to using it all the time, anytime they're involved in any form of sound therapy, whether in old days or modern days. These are the instruments that people use in what people now call sound healing or sound bath. I'm not in favor of these terms because they're gimmicky. They don't explain truly what's going on. I like to call it sound meditation, which is a term that has been around. I did not coin it. I just favor it because it tells you that you're doing something. Sound healing and sound bath are nebulous, disempowering. There's no active participation. And that's everything. So these frequencies that we hear when we listen to a gong, didgeridoo, singing bowl, bells, and overtone singing, chimes, so on and so forth, are the pure harmony. And humans everywhere in the world resort to using these instruments that allow us to hear these harmonics to clearly audible level. Most of the time, almost always, they are concealed. They're overshadowed by how loud the fundamental frequency is. They're there. You can measure them using software. But we like to hear them. Why? Something snaps back into the grid. It quiets the mind, the mental chatter, the monkey mind. It gives us a break from the self. It allows us to go into a deep introspective, contemplative, or meditative state where we become aware of the inner dialogue, change it, become equanimous with it, and stop exploring it. And eventually it takes us into hypnagogic state, a state that is between wakefulness and sleep, where basically we are awake, but there's no mental activities. So it's probably one of the few times that we're being a human being. Otherwise, we are human doings. We do things all the time in our head. And that inner doing seems what creates and at least impacts reality dramatically. So the harmonic series has always been important for humans for this particular reason I talked about, but also it's encoded within us. And this is where we get all harmonic systems that we've created from the origin. That blueprint of sound allows the various musical traditions out there, which are very different. People think that Indian classical music is different from Western classical music or Western music period because it's a different culture. Yes, true. But there's a lot more than that, and more than the instruments and the way the instruments are constructed. It's about the exploration of the mathematics of the octave. And that's what I'd like to draw attention to. These harmonics are bound together by mathematical ratios in a non-equal tempered system. In an equal tempered system, we no longer have the mathematical ratios. The reason why this harmonic series exists is to give us the tone color of any sound that we listen to. The tone color, the timbre, which is basically the fundamental frequency with various clusters of harmonics found within that particular sound of a flute, of a ukulele, of a piano, violin, human voice playing or singing that particular note. What the difference between one another is tone color, timbre. And this tone color is based on four variables, all related to the physics of the instrument, the size of the instrument, the shape of the instrument, the material that the instrument is made of. And the fourth one is the method that we use to play the sound on the instrument. Is it plucking string or bowing a string or hammering on a string, like in piano, or blowing air in the instrument? So there are various ways of producing that sound. These four variables give us the tone color. Same with the human voice. It's the way the vocal tract is shaped. The vocal tract is the distance between the vocal cords and the lips. All of these variables, how wide the throat is, how big or small the uvula is, and the soft palate, how high the hard palate is, the tongue, the teeth, all of these things create a different inner architecture of the buccal cavity and the vocal tract that would allow the sound coming from the vocal cords to be amplified within certain confinement of space, certain shaping of space. And that's how people can tell the difference between your voice, mine, or someone else's, Kermit the Frog. So you are changing that space, and that creates different physics so that when we speak, this inner architecture impacts the tone color, and that comes out as a uniquely shaped blob of sound that has an architecture. In physics, it's called waveform. That's the shape of the sound, the vibration that comes out of the mouth as we are speaking. And when we speak, the jaw opens and closes, and the tongue, the lips, the teeth. It's very intricate stuff that happens. People are not aware to what extent sound really creates reality. So language is a phenomenal processes of different sounds that the mouth can make. If it's based only on opening and closing the jaws, the vocal tract, then it's a vowel, and we create a specific symbol for each one. Consonants are vowels plus something, and we go through the different things depending on the language that is spoken. Different consonants and different vowels are used, of course. So these have a symbol, and you put these symbols together on a piece of paper, they create words. Same in speaking, you don't have to write that. And words have symbology, this inner visualization, the reference, the symbology. This is how reality is created, with words, with sound. The world exists because we have a language for it. Coincidentally, Terence McKenna said this so many times. What I'm saying here goes into the details of what does that mean? How does that come to be? How does that amount to this? And that creates vibration. And this vibration reverberates in your skull and in your face, in the jaws, in the skin on the face and chest and neck, and comes out of the mouth, goes and vibrates molecules in the air and vibrates the three bones in our inner ear. And this signal is taken to the brain and it's processed in the auditory cortex. Is very, very complex processes. So given how complex sound is and how sound is important in languages in creating reality, so yes, music is going to be very important in shamanism, especially when you take psychedelics. All shamans, or most shamans, I mean, so many shamans tell you that the Ikaro is the one doing the healing, especially Shipibo shamans in ayahuasca culture. I've spent many years trying to understand what does that mean? How does that come to me? To tell you that the Ikaro does the healing, you can use it by itself, but not ayahuasca by itself. Ultimately, you need both. That's not something a Western person is able to easily grasp and understand. What does that translate to every time you have a shamanic experience, whether using psychotropic plants or not, or substances, because they don't have to be plants for a psychedelic experience to happen, then there is sound and music. But there are so many people in the world who use music on its own and sound by itself without psychedelics. So it's very important to look deeper into this, to understand this phenomenon, because we are not researching the role of music and sound in psychedelics and in psychedelic research. We're not giving it so much attention.
So I understand the psychedelic experience allows us to change our story about ourselves. We're speaking about sound and words and changing a story. How do the psychedelics then, or I've heard you refer to them as supplements, potentiate this experience of sound? Are you more able to experience the transformational quality of sound in the context of a psychedelic experience? And why would that be?
Yeah, very good question. Let me first define or explain why I like to call them supplements. For someone who is studying sound and its connection to reality and God and major things, I like to pay attention to words that we use and the consequences of flippantly using language and the importance of being persnickety and use words judiciously with the right intention and not use something close to what we're trying to talk about, because there are consequences. So medicines, I don't believe they're medicines. They are technologies, sound and psychedelics, coming from plants or not. We'll get to that a little later. So they're technologies, natural organic technologies. Advil, aspirin, Tylenol are medicines. If you have a headache, take a couple of pills and don't do anything. Keep going about your day and the headache will go away. That's medicine. Psychedelics are tools to work with, to pay attention, how reality shifted. What does that mean? If this can happen inside of you, what is that telling you about who you are, about the world as you perceive it? How thoughts, feelings, and emotions create reality? How healing is letting go of the old narrative. Narrative therapy is what we're trying to do here. Letting go of the mythos, upgrading the mythos, the story, gaining back agency. Agency is our mindset, is will, intentions, attention, discernment, logic, reasoning, feeling, intuition, imagination, knowledge, all of these are agency. This is what we're trying to get to. It's wonderful that we are now giving them more and more attention, and there is this amazing attention and research that's happening, and a lot of great discoveries. But some of the most important things that should be part of this dialogue are the most pertinent and most important things, which is about the self. How can healing happen without agency? Now, what do we do as Westerners? We take the indigenous word for granted, the shaman's word for granted, and think that, well, the plants are there to heal us. They have an agenda to wake us up, to heal us. Well, there's no evidence of that. Plants are enormously intelligent. And now there's this commonly used sentence. I'm riffing a bit on this, but I'll come back to how sound and psychedelic work together, because it's so important to address this, because that's going to lay the ground and understand how sound does the work, the way it impacts the self. So I'll circle back to this. But you hear so much talk about plant medicines. Not everything we take is plant. And people talk about their mushroom experience and tell you how the plant medicine showed me and healed me. Well, let's talk about basics here. Mushrooms are fungi. Fungi, it's a whole other category. They're even closer to animals than to plants. So we can't call mushrooms plant. And then what is a spirit? Spirit is a word that came to shamanism from Latin. Who brought Latin to them? The oppressor, the colonizer, Christianity. Spirit means 25 different things in English. Not a good word to use. It creates 25 different realities, including alcohol, spirits. So spirit from spiri, from Latin, means breath. That's not precise enough. Whatever we don't know, we call it spirit. That's a pretty big bin now, 25 definitions. And not all plants, not only plants and fungi are medicines, technologies. There's great evidence that ketamine, MDMA, and LSD, these are made in a lab. It's true that LSD is found in ergot, in fungus that grows on wheat, but the spirit is in the molecule, it's not in the plant. It's the molecules in the plant or the chemicals made in the lab that are altering consciousness. So what humans do quite a lot is anthropomorphize something. They project human quality onto things outside of them. And by doing that, we do the very old thing, which is giving our power away. We look for a god, for a healer, for a shaman, for a guru, for an extraterrestrial to save us, to heal us. We should treat that with compassion and empathy, but admittance that this is what we do. And it's okay, but let's start with that. We need to take this conversation somewhere else. If we keep talking about the plant intelligence doing the healing, there is no evidence. Plants are enormously intelligent. And there's great evidence that fungi are even more intelligent. We haven't even started understanding this intelligence through ethnopharmacology, through chemistry, through biomimicry. And maybe understanding this intelligence one day is going to save us. But we make a very, very common mistake and a big assumption attributing this intelligence as plants being the savior. They're not. There is plenty of evidence that we seem to disconnect when we take psychedelics made in a lab or not. And also when we take psilocybin made in a lab, that's another thing that happens that people nowadays tell you, oh, I'm taking psilocybin. No, you're taking mushrooms. This is mushrooms. It's not psilocybin. Psilocybin is made in lab. They hear a lot of the word psilocybin, so they think that psilocybin is the technical word or the new word for mushrooms. They're called psilocybe cubensis, and there are many different strains. I mean, psilocybin containing mushrooms. So if we take psilocybin made in a lab or psilocin, psilocin is at the end what is giving us the trip, because psilocybin, when taken in mushrooms or in a capsule made in a lab, is hydrolyzed to psilocin, which is 5-hydroxy-DMT. Bifotenes is 5-hydroxy-DMT. So psilocin is the one, the chemical, the molecule that goes into receptors we have for serotonin, where the magic happens. What happens then? It's not just molecules going into receptors. This is where spirituality is. What happens when these molecules go into receptors? Where do we go? Where is that realm where the inner world becomes intertwined with the outer world, where we start to experience the likeness of God within us, where we have a direct relationship with the divine, becoming one with all plants, fungi, animals, humans, with the cosmos? All, we're exploring the mind. The mind is not the brain. We're exploring the true nature of reality and how our perceptions end up by framing this reality, labeling it, filtering it, and of course, the way we grew up, the parental imprinting, the education, society, culture, religions as operating systems and filters and lenses, the language that we use, the words, the beliefs, the indoctrination, the media, everything. So this is what we're trying to change and what we're bringing also from past lives, what we are dealing with from epigenetic material coming from our parents, grandparents, great-grandparents, all the way up to 14 generations. We all carry the database of what everyone has done up to 14 generations, and the material is there. If it's nurtured, then it can manifest. So it's very complex stuff we're dealing with. Let's not talk anymore about the plant spirit healing and doing that. So the default mode network is the egoic mind, is the concept of the self, is the ego. When we take psychedelics, we seem to disconnect a little bit or quite a lot from that. And by doing this, we gain a greater perception of what is going on in the bigger image, in the bigger umbrella of things, and what else is there to know and to experience. This is very important. Why? Because sound and music impacts our consciousness in the same way when we are listening to music at home, jogging, exercising, cooking, at a party, in a film. Music entrains you. It's the physics of sound, acoustics, that rule consciousness more than anything else. We have not started to try to understand why music is indispensable, why humans use music everywhere, following intuitive intelligence. Believe me, there must be a reason if we use music everywhere. Humans are enormously intelligent, and that intelligence is very highly reliable unless someone interferes in misguiding it and distracting people. Go look over there, which is how social engineering and social design works, or creating an industry like we did in the West, knowing that music is so important for humans, then we get people to listen to this kind of stuff or that kind of stuff, which is not so much about exploring consciousness, but getting us to become consumers, avid consumers. And we don't need to think hard to realize that music is the most popular art. I don't think it's an overstatement. Everybody listens to music. Not everybody goes to poetry reading and dance performances and art galleries and museums and other forms of art. Music is in all religious ceremonies, all shamanic ceremonies, all indigenous ceremonies for healing, transpossession, all syncretic religions, Jehovah religions, Eastern philosophies, in films, commercials, in football games, in weddings, parties. What is that about? And then look what we do in the West, given that we lost our shamanic traditions. We love to combine psychedelics with music at a rave, at a party, at a concert. What are we trying to do? Well, we're creating the shamanic model that we no longer have because we were distracted out of it, and it was banned and demonized and ridiculed, and it was replaced by so many other things, thanks to the development of culture, society, and the hegemony of our religions and laws and governments and politicians, all of that. But look at what people do, what kind of experiences they go through. But if they don't know what they're doing, if they don't know about set and setting, hopefully we think of the mindset that's abbreviated here as set as more than intention. and the setting, the safety of the setting, so that we don't freak out, where our consciousness becomes altered, where you can modify the temperature, the light, the smell, the noise, so that people can feel safe and be able to surrender, allow, trust, and accept, and let go, and not fight the experience. If they start to fight the experience, this is where the bad trip starts to happen. They're resisting it. So it's important for them to feel safe. And shamans develop this art. But this art, if we understand it correctly, can be taken a lot more than to what shamans do. This mindset and setting can be ameliorated tremendously, and the use of sound as well. Given that we're being told that music is the one doing the work in a shamanic experience, given that everywhere we boast about sound being God, music is used everywhere. It's the most powerful, useful art. We better take it seriously, especially in psychedelics. And so many people tell you that, you know, the music was my anchor, was my lifeline. The music was the mystical experiences I created with that. You can have mystical experiences with just music by itself. The Sufis have done this for centuries. Mantra systems, sutra systems are words and sentences being repeated, and they take you to different altered states of consciousness. So it's very important to look into how acoustics, the physics of sound, are impacting the brain, the heart, every aspect in the human body, and the energetic aspect of the self, and creating different connections in training the entire body with different music. So it's important to select something more suitable in the psychedelic experience than Beatles. I love the Beatles, but they're not the most suitable thing, I'm afraid, in the psychedelic experience. What can one choose? Well, first of all, let's look outside of equal temperament, because this harmonic series is encoded within us. Something I didn't mention, that humans sing and play instruments in non-equal temperament, even if they're conservative or trained throughout their life. When they have the chance to do that, when they're playing violins, because violins, violas, cellos, and basses have no frets. So you can play a little higher, a little lower to find that correct intonation. On a guitar, you can't do that because the string is divided with frets. On a piano, you can't do that because you have the keys. On a marimba, on a xylophone, you can't do that because you also have keys. But with the voice, with wind and brass instruments, you can overblow, underblow. And we tend to favor the non-equal temperament. That means it's encoded in us. So when we play something that creates sympathetic resonance, that thing better be an instrument where we can hear and feel these harmonics, different intonation than an equal temperament. Or musical cultures with more 12 half steps. Indian classical music has 22. Arabic and Persian have 24. Turkish, 53. Byzantine chants, the chants used in Greek Orthodox Church, have 72. So these are the things that I had to look deep into to understand deeply so many things related to consciousness, spirituality, and the psychedelic experience, and what people do everywhere in the world. I've done field work, short-term field work in over 40 countries in the past 22 years, a little over 22 years, understanding what people do and how they talk about it. But to go further, I try to understand what are they trying to address, talk about, but they don't have the language. And we find mirroring of that everywhere in the world. Why? It's so important to take the two most powerful tools that humans have used to create the sophisticated art form philosophy that we call shamanism. But it's not about only what they're talking about. It's a lot more than that. Why? We're resorting to them once again, and we're taking a fresh look at them. But we need a multidisciplinary approach.
Well, and this is a great segue to speak about the specific protocol for what you call sound meditation. First of all, let me just say, I love that you don't like the term sound healing. I also don't like the term sound healing. I think that it's kind of prescriptive in a way. I love the idea of sound meditation. And this is a protocol of an integrated experience that helps disconnect from habitual patterns. Right. And there are specific elements that come together to create this protocol. There are folks listening to the podcast who are going to want to go a lot deeper on your work, but just as an overview, can you lay out what that protocol actually is, the different pieces to it? You've talked about mindset and safe setting to begin with, but there are a lot of other pieces that come into that protocol. Can you speak a bit on that?
Certainly. So what I spent a lot of time trying to understand is there a structure in shamanism? How do we know what are the processes at work? What seems to be going on in here? And how can we better understand what's going on so that we focus on things in a more judicious, focused way so that we don't become dogmatic? And over the years, what I realized that these following points are very important in creating a sophisticated shamanic-like setting. And it's not something that I created as theory, but I also practiced, applied indirect experiences to test it, to see whether this truly what's going on, whether it can be improved, ameliorated, tweaked, and whether it helps create more, I don't like the word controlled, but to be sensitive to this setting. So the mindset is very important, and that's the first part, to prepare the mindset, to prepare coming with the mindset, intentions, will, awareness, presence of mind, reasoning, discernment, intuition, curiosity, belief, passion, imagination, inspiration, and knowledge. The context, I give 2 to 7 hour long talk before I do anything to contextualize things, and I address things that people are going to be working with, sound, music, spirituality, consciousness, to understand psychedelics in a non-dogmatic way, shamanism, mystery school teaching, the inner world, and so on and so forth. The setting, safety of the setting, controlling, adjusting temperature, sound, smells, and noise to protect from any noise pollution, promoting a meditative state or a contemplative, introspective, self-reflective state or a mindful state in the experience, which is sit down, close your eyes, wear a mask, and go inwards. Pay attention to the inner world. Starting with the breathing exercises, that's another element, diaphragmatic breathing exercises, to help loosening up the abdomen, massaging the vagus nerve as it goes through the diaphragm, and to move about the organs, because the vagus nerve, the instrument of the autonomic nervous system that starts at the brainstem, wraps around the esophagus, goes between the lungs through the diaphragm, and gets attached to every organ that we have in our abdomen and ends at the sphincter. Visualizations and guided visualizations are also important. Guided perception and verbal guidance to guide people toward certain areas, taking them, making sure that they're not getting stuck in loops and rumination or in this mental diarrhea that's with us all the time. It goes with us quite often to the visionary state. The visionary state, when we take psychedelics, unfolds on the mental, emotional, physical, visual, spiritual, and energetic levels. Very often people confuse visuals with visions. No, visuals are one aspect of the visions. So toning and vocalization are also very important to experience the voice through tone and bone and tissue conduction. That's what happens when we hum. We feel our voice. We don't just hear it. The way it travels in the jaws, in the skull, in the skin, the cheeks, face, neck, and chest, and the rest of the body. Working with overtone emitting instruments. These are the gongs, singing bowls, etc. And working with non-equal tempered music as well. One can use playback music or play live, but it's important for it to be non-equal tempered and better if it's in more than 12 semitones to get into more intricacies of the octave. And applying judicious and equanimous listening to really pay attention to how the individual's own reality is being shaped, impacted, entrained by the music the individual is listening to. and the instruments, and olfactory stimuli. This is another element in this structure. Olfactory stimuli basically are what you experience when you smell sage, Palo Santo, orange blossom water, rose water, lavender, essential oils, all of these things. You're smelling harmony, basically. It's in training the self through these olfactory stimuli that are olfactory harmonies and promoting good handling of the supplements, not like taking whatever the person's taking and thinking that, oh, the plant spirit's going to heal me. No, it's a technology. It's a technology to be used in a very, very attentive, skillful, and a way that exhibits respect to one's own consciousness. Yeah, so this is, in short, the different elements that creates the sound meditation. Of course, all of this can stand without the supplements, and it would be a very powerful experience. I facilitated that to thousands of people, but I also facilitated to people with supplements in countries where it's legal to do that, to test this model. And it works all the time.
And when you say it works, this will kind of bring us back a little bit towards the beginning of the conversation. When you say it works, what are the effects that you're seeing with the folks that are coming in to have these experiences? I understand that with psychedelic healing, we're often speaking a lot about the need to integrate, to have sort of like a follow-on cultivation of experience after the experience itself. But I imagine that you've tracked the results of this work and how people's lives have changed and blossomed. You've talked a lot about the value of sound and psychedelics. I'm curious, when you use this particular protocol, what changes are you seeing in the people who have the privilege of getting to have that experience with you?
Yes, I have tracked this very much so and try to understand it to a deeper level, whether with others or with my own self. Exposing them to this three-partite structure, first, the contextualization, sharing with them why these are powerful tools and what they need to know to use these tools, the knowledge of how to use these tools, because the more powerful the tool is, the more knowledge we need to use it correctly, because a powerful tool can be used positively or negatively. And the more powerful it is, the more good or damage we can do with. Sound is one. Music is another. As well, psychedelics, knowledge as well. So the second part is the direct experience. The third part is the processing and integration, the most important part. What are you going to do with all of that? How are you going to bring back into everyday life and let go of the impact of past conditioning, the parental imprinting and the traumas, the PTSD, which I call post-traumatic stress injury, all of these ribbons that we carry from the past. And we can't let go of these experiences. It's what we are doing with them or what we don't do with these ribbons is what creates the post-traumatic stress disorder or injury. Basically, we are experiencing the present moment through all of these lenses and filters. So sound, music, through the psychedelic experience allow us to, this is my own analysis and my own belief and my own understanding, it seems to get us to connect to gnosis. Gnosis is very, very important concept here to bring into the picture because that's the ultimate point of the psychedelic experience, I believe. Gnosis is conscious knowledge, intuitive, imaginative, and inner knowledge. It is knowledge of the heart, the knowledge we acquire through our own experience as opposed to knowledge that we are told, we believe in. And gnosis is conscious and not merely intellectual or conceptual knowledge, belief, or theory. Gnosis is not an intellectual wisdom, but rather a knowledge that is experienced through feeling, through being, through an embodiment and knowledge from the unconscious. It is the tradition that gave birth to our most respected philosophies, sciences, and art and religions. Coincidentally, this term gnosis is synonymous with the Hebrew Da'at in Kabbalah and the Sanskrit Nya or Vidya in the Tibetan prajna or rigpa. So Carl Jung said, I know, I don't need to believe. It's the inner knowing that we can tap into through contemplation, meditation, through spirituality, through vipassana retreat, isolating the self from all of these things. So when we take psychedelics, we seem to connect to gnosis, the embodied knowledge, because of the traditions that preserved shamanism. We tend to call it something else, the plant spirit. We project it outside. We externalize it. We attribute it to the plant intelligence. Not quite that. Again, if we take supplements, if we take molecules made in a lab, there is no thing that's alive, whether it's fungi or plant. The trip is there. So how could that be? Then it must be the molecules going into receptors and altering the way we experience reality, the transduction of this reality, the way our brain transduces, transceives what we create as reality, impacted by what we bring to it through our parental imprinting, indoctrination, education, and all of these things I stated earlier. The tendencies, these are filters and lenses. So all of that gnosis would lead us to understand that we are part of the logos. We are one with the logos. Logos is another very important concept here. It's important to mention. That's the nature of the universe. Logos in ancient Greek philosophy and theology is very complex. It's an enormously rich and fascinating doctrine from where the concept of God comes from. It is the universal ordering principle, the divine reason implicit in the cosmos, ordering it and giving it form and meaning. It is the word, the discourse, universal language, the ultimate system, mediation. The Pythagoreans and Neoplatonists, which should be called the Neo-Pythagoreans, told us that the logos is not made of mathematics. Mathematics is the universal language, a very precise and accurate language that we use to understand, fathom, measure, and experience, and transmit it as well. The logos is expressed in fields, phenomena, systems, patterns, balance, symmetry, ratios, energy and visual patterns, frequencies, processes, relationship, aesthetics, order, harmony. We experience it as music, sound, sacred geometry, mathematical constants, tessellation patterns, psychedelic visual patterns, fractals, et cetera, et cetera. So coincidentally, this is what we see in a psychedelic experience. Visuals are these fractal-like geometry, and visuals that people may describe them as fractals or sacred geometry. But where do these come from? What is this about? I think we're experiencing the metadata that eventually becomes this reality that we are experiencing now. So it's very important to realize that approaching it in an attentive way, in a non-dogmatic way, in a way to empower the individual, would ensure thorough use of psychedelics as technologies, because the whole point is to not only heal. By the way, when we take them, we don't only experience healing in therapy. It's mostly rehabilitation. Rehabilitation, we experience in education, regeneration, rejuvenation, revealing of the true nature of things. We often and only talk about healing. It's not just healing. So we're being informed about so many important things, but all of them are about the self, the mind, the I, the one labeling, the one calling things, the one naming. So this is the one that's being impacted, and we create reality through naming. Kierkegaard said the very powerful sentence, if you name me, you negate me. If you name me, you negate me. You create a thing out of me, create a label. And by doing that, I start to be. And you lock me into particles of being and becoming just that, no longer be upgraded. And that's our problem, is that we label things from an early age. And even when we grow and our consciousness evolves, these labels are still the same. what I said earlier, that reality is a process to navigate through and not just to go through, to understand, to demystify. It's about changing labels. It's about changing the mythos. Mythos, logos, ethos, and pathos are very, very important to understand. Ethos is what my language communicates to you and others, what the music is communicating, the distinguishing quality, the character, the personality, the attitude. When it's being heard, internalized, when it goes into other people's ears, becomes pathos, a certain reality on the emotional, mental, physical, all of these things. So these are the structures of reality. So it's very important to take a multidisciplinary approach when we deal with psychedelics to understand how can these two powerful things, what humans use to create shamanism, sound, music is included when I say sound, in psychedelics, help saving us or help us to save ourselves more correctly. There's no agenda here. We are the ones that we're ready for ourselves. We are the saviors. We are the ones who need to awaken. And it's not about an outer process. It's an inner process. We need to bring spirituality to shamanism because the way it's taken out of context, assuming that whatever this tribe is talking about, and they all talk about different things, and they all take different supplements, different plants and cacti and fungi. What's going on? Who is right? They're all right, but that's the best that they can do. We can't treat them in a dogmatic way. We come from dogma, so it's easy for us to apply dogma. We need to grow up. We need to understand them. We need to realize that science needs to grow up too. We need to bring spirituality into science, spirituality into shamanism. We need to take a multidisciplinary approach. We're all trying to talk about the same thing, but it's so complex, so humongous, that it accommodates an infinite of different cosmological models that we lose the self in.
So as you say, these are powerful, powerful tools. You've developed a powerful protocol that's having major impact. And at the same time, people are using some of these tools in the wrong way. They don't really have a full understanding. And maybe as simple as they're just playing the wrong music in a ceremony, or all the way to the end of their being extremely dogmatic about that. And so I did want to touch on at the end some of the pitfalls of working with these tools, with an eye to the fact that many of our listeners are practicing facilitators supporting psychedelic healing. But yeah, let's just take a moment to speak about any of the issues that we need to be aware of when we're working with these powerful tools in supporting the healing of others.
So first of all, it's very important to rephrase this correctly, that we are very grateful to the indigenous people that they've kept these traditions alive against all odds, because Christianity, colonization, and other religions eradicated almost entirely shamanism. Fortunately, a lot of bits and pieces of shaman survived against all odds. But it's very important to address the issues involved in shamanism currently in the Western world, that when we don't understand what shamanism is about and what shaman does, we fall into very debilitating patterns. Falling into dogmatic behavior means not questioning what's going on or trying to understand a deeper truth to it. Second, frequency over quality. So many people go and guzzle ayahuasca as many times as possible per month, per year, thinking that the more they do that, the more the plant spirit is going to heal them. No, as we pointed earlier, that processing and integration impacting the ego. So also, not all shamans are shamans. Some of them are ayahuascaers. That means they're trained to facilitate ayahuasca, if it's ayahuasca culture. Some call themselves healers. For me, the healer is the receiver. And healers, what we call healers, are healing facilitators. It's another incorrect use of words. So we have the detriment of the commercialization of shamanic practices. This is also very important to address. A consequence of taking things out of their context, the lack of deep understanding of the shamanic methods, practices, and philosophies, the repeated abuse, emotional, financial, and sexual abuse that happens in the shamanic experience, and revering the shaman and putting him or her on a pedestal. And then when they crash, we blame the shaman, not taking accountability that it's because of us also that this happened. So basically, all of this and more, the mishandling of psychedelics, even when there's no shaman, even when we're dealing only with substances made in a lab, there's a whole series that I've observed, again, to I distinguish between making an observation and making judgment. Making an observation is not necessarily to be seen as making judgment. We need to be able to talk about things that are difficult to address. Why? Because they involve the ego. Because we have done a good job getting each other over, I'm more right than you are, on all levels. On the racial level, the religious level, the political level, the national level, and this goes on and on and on, and that is being used to separate people, to create this old agenda that works all the time, divide and conquer, divide and rule. We need to come together as a human race and realize that what the world is going through is a consciousness crisis. We're not addressing it like that. Remember that the inner world impacts the outer world. Everybody needs healing. And that's what's promising now, that psychedelics can be our great tools to use, but we need to understand that using powerful tools requires powerful handling knowledge, a thorough handling and powerful knowledge, and a lot of understanding. So if we don't, we're missing out on great opportunity. Everybody needs healing, especially those leaders who are impacting things on a high level, political leaders, religious leaders, economical on all levels. So some of the pitfalls of working with powerful tools, again, these powerful tools can be psychedelics, can be knowledge, can be being in a position of power, can be sound. On top of the list is ego inflation. Instead of shaping the ego and mowing it down and diminishing it and transmutating it, transforming negative energy to positive energy, it's about alchemy at the end. That's what psychedelics are about. So instead, we get ego inflation. People start to use psychedelics to make themselves think that there are now messiahs and God put them on earth to help people here. That's messianism. Okay. So spiritual superiority is another one. What I call latent narcissistic humanity or latent narcissistic shamanism, playing shaman, playing humble to gain social credit, spiritual bypassing, spiritual materialism, labeling the self as healer, as a master, even after having had 1 week of instruction on a gong or in sound or Reiki or whatever, Reiki master, after 2 days of instruction. You know, really pathological altruism and cultural appropriation, that's very, very common these days. Going native or indigenous, talking, acting, believing, dressing like an indigenous person. Let's not throw everything that we are and go native and start to behave like native. That is all about the ego. Like, watch me, look at me, I am this now. I'm not saying it's always negative, but quite often can disguise the ego to wear a new cape and infiltrate itself and it becomes about me, me, me. It's narcissism that separated us from non-duality and we became in duality. It's the separation. We are fallen gods. We lost the divine and we are to recover that. This is what mystical traditions are trying to teach us. Sufism, mystical Islam, and Kabbalah, mystical Judaism. Mysticism is very important to bring back. Imitating without understanding, virtue signaling. All of these things are very important to address as shamanism and psychedelics become more and more popular and used and people develop interest. Why? Because at the end, what these substances with thorough use are allowing us to establish is connection to our heart, is to recreate the balance with the inner feminine and masculine. And what I'm calling here masculine is discernment that we've prioritized in patriarchy and in book religions also asserted that is logic, discernment, the intellect, power, strength, aggression, reasoning, guilt and shame as well, anger, revenge, decision-making, resentment. And what I'm labeling feminine, you can call this yin and yang. Yeah? Yin is feminine. Feminine to me is inspiration, creativity, gratitude, kindness, love, being in service, surrender, nurturing, patience, intuition, imagination, empathy, all of these things. We lost that. We are a species out of balance. We are a species disconnected from our heart. Through creating more opportunity, greater opportunity to create this neuroplasticity that we can shape the brain, create new neural pathways, changing the narrative, and create neurogenesis, means the brain can create new neurons, letting go of the old highways, the old neural pathways, the neural clusters, and create new ones. That's what it means to change reality, and new practice is doing just that. Well, psychedelics facilitate this tremendously. But what we are dealing with is parasitic force that years ago, I overlooked and I thought, whatever. But then I started looking deeply into these various names that different cultures, indigenous peoples, religions have given to this parasitic force that has been plaguing human consciousness for quite a long time. It's been called the Archons, means the rulers, by the Gnostics. It's been called Shaitan in Sufism, Satan in Kabbalah, mystical Judaism, the general law in esoteric Christianity, the lords of destiny in Hermeticism. Castaneda, in his work on shamanism, called it the topic of all topics, the flyers, the predators. Gurdjieff called it the evil magician. In Native American spirituality, was called Wetiko. Paul Levy wrote beautiful books about Wetiko, which he said he defined as Wetiko is a psycho-spiritual disease of the soul, a mind virus or mental blindness that works through the blind spots of the unconscious. This is his definition. Basically, the way I observe it's working in me and others and people that I work with, people who, because of their past, because of their attachment to their suffering, their addiction to, we all are addicted to shame and guilt and anger, resentment, self-loathing, self-victimization, fear and all that. Why are these negative emotions that we create are highly addictive? What happened to the evolved self? Why do we become addicted to something that is causing us to degrade? What is that force? Well, it seems that there's a parasitic force that creating the likelihood for us to be tricked by our own perceptions, lose our agency, and we become addicted to maluse our own energy, malinvestment, mismanagement of our own energy. And we start to become addicted to the fact that we grew up with mom who was like that, or dad who was like that, or an ex or ex-boss, all these things that we try to hear from these traumas could be numerous number, but these are the most common things that people come to heal from. And we lose agency. But that's our own energy that's being used to cause harm. And when we can't deal with that anymore, what do? We self-medicate with alcohol, with nicotine, legal drugs first, sugar, caffeine as well, and opiates and bad drugs, coke and heroin and crystal meth and crack cocaine, and even psychedelics, ketamine. People self-medicate with that, and sometimes with the other psychedelics. So that's misunderstanding of the nature of the problem and mishandling the power of the molecule that we put in our system and how to work with that. So this parasitic force ties to very main archetype that is to perceive as a polar opposite of Christ consciousness. Christ consciousness, that means you were kept in the dream. You realize that you and the Logos are one. The Logos is Christ consciousness. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The Word here is mistranslation to the Logos, which I defined earlier. So this new parasitic force that Zoroastrianism talked about, the first monotheistic religion, is Ahriman, Ahriman in Farsi. Rudolf Steiner talked extensively about Ahriman, A-H-R-I-M-A-N. So Ahriman is to be seen, understood as the polar opposite from Christ consciousness, a main archetype that becomes so attractive to us to explore. And by doing that, it takes us in the polar opposite Christ consciousness. And that is manifesting through mindless technological advancement and scientific materialism, through transhumanism, being addicted to gadgets and to iPhones and computers and being disconnected from our heart, from each other, connecting through social media, being disconnected from nature. We no longer have the symbiotic relationship that we once had with nature. Symbiosis is everyone wins at the end. It's everyone needs everyone else. In the same way that the bees and birds and insects need the nectar and flowers, and the flower needs these guys to take their pollen to cross-pollinate, we were part of this. We still witness this in the mycelium and the complexity of nature. Now, humans started capitalizing on all of that, and we split, and we started feeling self-entitled, and we polluted everything and exploited Earth and all resources, and now creating chaos. How do we get to become so parasitic? We are some of the most intelligent species on Earth. How did that happen? I think at the end, the parasitic force, the archonic forces, and Ahriman are trying to accelerate the degradation to teach us something very important. At the end, they are allies. They're allies trying to teach us about the true nature of reality, the true nature of suffering, about how we create evil and we create good, and how the inner world, what we have gone through, causes us to create good or evil, and to understand the nature of how the outer world is impacted with the inner world, by the inner world, and that they are one and the same. That's what as above, so below means. Inner world is one with the outer world. So it's important to study these different mystical traditions, Eastern philosophies and Gnosticism, Hermeticism, and mystery school teaching, and what quantum physics is trying to tell us, and new discoveries in the scientific understanding of psychedelics and shamanic traditions, but don't take one thing. It's very important to, through a process of syncretism and through distilling and connecting the dots in a new way, taking a multidisciplinary approach to understand what do we do now, a few seconds to midnight, now that we're dealing with the two most powerful tools. Consciousness fine-tuned itself and made a lot of things available to us. Meditation, yoga, Eastern philosophies, spirituality, shamanism. You can drink ayahuasca now anytime you want. You couldn't do that 30 years ago or in medieval days. And if you're in Europe, you'd be lucky to get your hands on henbane or mandrake or maybe Amanita muscaria mushroom. Now you can do very... What is this about when you do it? What is that telling you about reality? It's waking up and realizing that all tools, there are not shortcuts, they're wormholes, psychedelics. At the end, it's very important to learn what to do with them. And the meditative, contemplative, introspective, self-reflective, or mindful state applied in the psychedelic experience, all of these are so important to understand the nature of being, because we are trying to let go of the misuse of our own energy invested in self-harm, harm to each other and the world and nature. This is what's causing this consciousness crisis. No, I see it like that. I grew up in 14 years of war in Beirut, Lebanon. I come from an experience. I became deathly ill and I lost two vital organs. There's a reason why I see and understand things differently and why I do the work differently than others. Suffering is the training. That's a good change of the narrative. We need to see that. We need to see it, that the wounded healer archetype is the archetype of humanity, not just those who are quote-unquote healing facilitators.
You speak of waking up, and I am so grateful that one of the alarm clocks we have to wake up is the beautiful sonorous sound meditations that you have been offering and you've been teaching others. Very grateful for your time, for your wisdom, for all of your insight today on these very complex subjects. Where can our listeners go to learn more about you? And we'll have your website in the show notes. Is there any place that people can continue to track your work beyond your website, or trainings that people can get involved in? How can people connect with you?
Through my website. I'm not big on social media. I understand their value, but I prefer to deal with people. I I'm only on Facebook. I use it in a suitable way to spread good knowledge and not like, look at me, look what I'm doing now. Social media can be used in a good way without promoting narcissism, but in a way to push consciousness forward and to elevate things. So I'm only on Facebook if people want to connect to me on that. And my website, soundmeditation.com. I have a lot of my research, scientific studies I've done, a lot of podcast interviews people do with me, video lectures, a lot of resources, videos I create to explain complex sound phenomena in a fathomable way to people who have never studied music and sound. I also lead a nonprofit collective that I created called Resonant Mind on resonantmindcollective.com. Resonant as in resonance. And that's about it. I'm not on Twitter. I'm not on Instagram. I'm not on TikTok. I'm not on LinkedIn. Sorry. But you can send me an email through my website. I do have recordings that people can purchase. At this point, they can only purchase 6 albums for sound meditation by sending me an email directly. At some point soon, they will be available on the website. These are 6 albums that I created 8 years ago. They didn't get a chance to put them on the website yet because I'm juggling with so many balls and I try to be the student, the apprentice, and discover new things. And I still unravel all of these things because there's so many layers, so many things to learn about. So yeah, these are the few things that people can check to learn more about my work. And there's a lot of content on my website that can keep people busy for quite a long time. And I do have a lot of tracks that people can use and download for free as well through my website. They can get to my SoundCloud. I have a YouTube channel that they can access from my website as well.
And we'll put all of that in the show notes, so that'll be easy for our listeners to check in with. So thanks again for coming on the show and for your wisdom and so many beautiful topics today. It's really been a pleasure.
Happy to be on the show and look forward to following up with you on many things.
Thank you for joining us on the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please join the Psychedelic Therapy Facebook group to talk about it. You can also share it with your friends or leave a review on iTunes so more people can discover the show. The Psychedelic Therapy Podcast is presented by Maya, a platform designed to help psychedelic therapists manage and measure client journeys. You can head to mayahealth.com to learn more. The show is for informational purposes only and is not intended to provide mental health or medical advice. Thanks for listening.